I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Bruce Bernstein. He's executive director of SWAIA, which stands for Southwest Association for Indian Arts, and he's the author of the new book, Santa Fe Indian Market, A History of Native Arts and the Marketplace. He will be signing books at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 14th of August at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
So Indian Market is something that probably most Santa Feans take for granted, most Santa Feans have been to often many times, and certainly collectors from all over the world. When did it start? What was it all about when it started?
Well, Indian Market's been here 91 years. The first year of Indian Market was 1922, and in that year it was actually called Indian Fair. And it was connected to the museums, it was connected to tourism, connecting to making community spirit. It was also seen very much to be an economic venture to help Pueblo people who were very destitute after 300 years or so of colonialism that had left them land and water poor and population far depleted.
And so it's one of those things, and reading your book, it's so interesting to, I mean, and kind of painful to look at that kind of mixed bag, because on the one hand, you know, from the perspective I was trying to imagine of an Indian at that time, okay, they've taken away pretty much everything we have, but they're going to give us back, you know, a few bucks if we make some pots, and not even the pots that we make, but the pots that they imagine that we should be making.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very accurate reading. I think it is a mixed bag, and it's still a mixed bag in many ways, and I think that the history of market is actually very, very positive, and that's actually what interested me so much to begin writing and researching the history of market, was I had those mixed emotions about it, both being this fantastic event and so exciting and so forth, but there were things about it that were bothersome, having to do with the dictation by the dominant society about what is and what is not native, the authenticity question, as we call it. And in those first years of market, there were a series of people, most famously Edgar Hewitt, who was the director of the museum, and Hewitt felt very strongly that he would be able to reenact his archaeology through living people. He felt that the pre-Hispanic time in the Southwest, pre-1600, was more native than how people were at 1900 or 1920, so he felt that people return to that pre-Hispanic period, they would in fact be Indian or more native at that point. So all of his direction was at recreating ancestral or prehistoric archaeological pottery, and it was a stultifying idea to ask people to replicate something. And the other thing, when you look at those pots today, what you begin to realize is, sure, the person could duplicate the design on the pot, but they're still a person of their moment, of their time. So the pot still looks like a 1913 pot from San Ildefonso, but the design is clearly copied from ancestral villages up on the Pajarito Plateau.
Sort of like watching a movie from 1955 depicting a turn-of-the-century scene.
You still know, yes, you still know that. I think that's an important lesson. And I think for the first Indian markets, I think it's incredible to think about, yes, that these women, the potters in particular, who stood there at that first Indian fair in 1922, that they had been told repeatedly through schooling and through government that their culture really had no value and they needed to change. And then suddenly here these women are standing and people are celebrating their culture. And they're telling them that it's all good to make their culture. And what a fabulous thing that people were given the resources or the ability to use something from their own culture, like pottery, to recast themselves in the Americanization of the Southwest. Certainly from the perspective of today, why weren't they being offered to be doctors and lawyers and school teachers and engineers and things like that? There is that sort of insidious side to what people were being asked to do, which was to remain as native people for tourism, which doesn't sound so good out loud. But again, the way that the potters and the people out of the communities turned that around and really made it theirs is something to really celebrate.
Now, was pottery a women's job at that time and today?
Well, pottery has always been a family job. There's always been men involved. I know there's a lot of more male potters. We know more about potting, or we think we know more about potting today because people have written things or the pots are signed and things like that. but husbands had always helped, or family members, male family members had always helped with some of the more labor-intensive things like gathering the clay and preparing the clay, maybe the firing and so forth. So whether there are more male potters today has more to do that there's signatures on the bottoms of pots than anything else, and that there have always been males involved in pottery making. It's just a matter that it's more known to the outside world now.
What did the early works look like, artworks that they were selling at Indian Market in, 91 years ago, and what kind of records do we have of that?
Well, we have a pretty good record. There's a photographic record that's really quite stunning, and then there's archival pieces here and there, and then archival papers, what I mean to say, that people wrote about it. It's in the newspaper and so forth. So there's those types of resources, so secondary and primary resources. The most stunning things, though, to learn about the first Indian Market are some of the actual prize winners, which are here in Santa Fe at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. I was actually there. I was chief curator and director at that museum for several years. And one night late, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, I was working in my office in the Laboratory of Anthropology building, and I was looking at the photographs from the first Indian Market in 1922, and I looked more closely at this one photo of the table, and I said, well, I can't tell you what I really said, but I said basically, wow, look at that piece. I know that piece. First thing next morning, went down to the collections, and there the piece is on the shelf. I'd never realized that piece was 1922, over 50 inches in circumference winner. If people are interested in seeing that, go up to the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. It's on display in the Here, Now, and Always exhibition. So those types of things, and looking at the... We have a record, photographic and paper, from the Anglo side. But from the Native side, there's certainly... I've talked to many people over the years, so there's some recollection. But the best record is actually the pieces made for those years to really understand what people were thinking about and what they were doing.
So do you have... the actual in collections or in museums, you have the prize-winning pieces from each year of Indian Market?
There's list of prize winners, but many of the pieces we don't know where they are necessarily, and there's not prize lists for every one of the 91 years, probably about half or so in existence. There's a pretty good job of keeping records in the first 10 years, and then there's a couple ledger books that are quite fascinating, actually, that there's actually one of the ledger books, one page depicted, and it's a great page because all these famous names are on that page. You can see the prize money and the prize awards that people got in those years.
So what were the pots like? I mean, there have been some continuities and also some real changes in what people were making and offering and why.
Well, pottery at that time was very much Puebloan and will always be Puebloan. And I think that if there was a reincarnated Pueblo person from 1,000 years ago that came and looked at the table at 1922, they would see it and understand it as Pueblo pottery. There are those continuities over the history of time of Pueblo pottery that are undeniable. But the really wonderful, brilliant, the centerpiece, the Indian Market, has to do with Julian Maria Martinez from San Ildefonso. And they had worked 10 years to create a new type of pottery based upon old forms, an innovation, perhaps we'd call that, that would be sellable to the non-native world. So they had worked on that concept. They had been given the idea by Director Hewitt that they should replicate pots. And they saw that was just mind-numbing to do that. They then began to work on other things, and with a curator at the museum's name was Kenneth Chapman. With Chapman, they began to conceptualize what it was that the Anglo world would be interested in, and they came up with the idea of a very glossy surface and emphasizing form of the pot, and then they came up with the idea of putting some type of iconography on that. So in the winter of 1919-1920, they came up with the first two blacks, or black-on-black pottery. It was a round jar, with an avanyu, or water serpent, around it. And that jar then turns into what becomes the first Indian Market pottery, and what we associate so much with traditional pottery. So there was a brand new or innovative form of pottery for that first Indian Market. And without Indian Market, Maria Martinez and Julian Martinez would not have had the market to sell things. But without their pottery, there never would have been the success of that first year of Indian Market.
It's so interesting because it really gives a complexity to the idea of authenticity. Because this black on black, which we think of as the most traditional and collectible and beautiful Indian pottery, was made for the market. It wasn't what people had been using traditionally for, I mean, forget about centuries or millennia even at all.
Well, of course, the word tradition is slippery in whatever that tradition is and what we consider that to be. You know, that people by 1900 had a great deal of manufactured goods. People had changed their households as a result of the Spanish being here. People had, for most famously, if you think about wheat and the introduction of wheat, in Pueblo agriculture is probably not until about 1800. But pottery is then reused in terms of making dough bowls and storage jars for wheat production, wheat storage, and bread making and things like that. Yet today we call those traditional. But in the longer history of Pueblo people, it's a very quick blink of the eye if it's just 100 or 200 years old. So to say something is household use or not, the thing about pottery that remains consistent through time is not so much looking at use per se, but the principles or cultural values that go into the making of the pottery, that the making of the pot itself represents who Pueblo people are. So the act of going out on the landscape where your ancestors have been, where your future ancestors will go, and taking two very sacred substances, that of the clay itself and water, mixing those two substances together, and then holding another very fertile, very sacred substance being water. Those principles of pottery don't change over time, whether it's 1,000 years ago or today. And that's what's consistent about pottery, not so much that it's a bean pot or it's a pot for a shelf.
Or a pot for the market.
Or a pot for the market, that's right. That's the shelf part.
The shelf, okay.
The shelf.
We're talking to the director of SWIA, Bruce Bernstein, and we're talking about the book Santa Fe Indian Market, A History of Native Arts and the Marketplace. There were all sorts of things, well, lots of things that I didn't know about. For example, there's this thing called, what was it, the baby contest?
Baby contest, yes. Baby contest was very much part of the 1920s Indian markets. And there was a great deal of disease, particularly baby sort of disease, glaucoma being one of those things with communities. And there was a great deal of health concerns. And so it was a way to get babies in doctors' hands. The doctors were always the judges, actually. And it was a way to get examination of the babies. And, of course, babies are always appealing besides anything else. But the baby contest ended after 1 year, after a child was handled by a non-native mother in the baby contest. The baby died, and that was the end of the contest at that point. Probably rightfully so.
Right. Well, it was so interesting to see, for example, when Indian Market started here in Santa Fe was also, as you write in your book, coincided with the time where Indian culture was being eradicated entirely from the boarding schools, and Indian dances were prohibited on reservations, mm-hmm. and yet they wanted them to dance as theater,
right,
for the public.
That's right. It is such an interesting moment because there is such a movement from the government to stop Indian culture and change Indian culture, and as in the words of the time, to create productive citizens of them. So what a great thing that this happened here in Santa Fe. And you can imagine that the Commissioner of Indian Affairs didn't come, but he sent his representative out. And in his opening words for the first Indian Fair, he says something like, it's great that older Native people make these arts and crafts, but young Native people ought to get on with it, become productive citizens. So again, he's commenting on the idea that people should go to Indian school, which is mostly vocational, technical training, house painters, laundresses, bakers, and so forth, and get out of the sort of holding on to culture. Luckily, nobody listened, and people.
But a lot of people had their culture eradicated who
went
through the school.
Well, there's so much. Yeah, there's so much that goes on. But through market, the sort of understanding of the situation of Pueblo people was better known. So if you look at a place like San Ildefonso, for example, in 1922, one of the things that's happened at San Ildefonso is you have 240 people living in the village, but only about 90 of those people are San Ildefonsans. You have 2,500 acres under cultivation for agriculture, but only about 200 of those acres are San Ildefonsans. So other people had stepped in. So by producing pottery, selling pottery, getting Pueblo culture in front of dominant society, people learn more about Pueblo culture.
There was something that you wrote in the book about some of the changes that happened at Indian Market over time, especially toward the beginning. The pottery was, it became smaller, it became simplified, and there were these pseudo-ceremonial pots. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Pseudo-ceremonial pottery. Well, like you're saying, there's kind of, I suggest that there's four ways that pots were changed for the tourism market. Smaller, obvious, helps people carry them home, they can go in suitcases, less expensive, and actually less investment by the potter as well. And one of those things is pseudo-ceremonial, as I call it. And that is that people were very interested in Pueblo religion. There was a great deal of interest in Pueblo ceremonialism as the original American religion, as being something people that were searching for themselves and a broader understanding of the world. They turned to Pueblo ceremonies as a way to understand how other people understood and participated in that world. So Pueblo people recognized that a lot of outsiders wanted to get in to understand the ceremonialism, and they understood too that they were not going to get in and have that intrusiveness. So people made a lot of pseudo-ceremonial things, like they put applique frogs on pots. They actually created other sorts of scenes on pottery that to an outsider may appear to be ceremonial, but to the Pueblo person, they knew they were just sort of putting a gate up at the kiva that you can have this pot, but you can't come in here.
Right.
So it was a way to satisfy the market at the same time to sort of keep people at a distance.
In a long line of kind of playing with the minds of outsiders,
yes,
which has happened in probably every native society,
yes,
that's become hip to anthropologists and,
yeah,
and visitors from the outside.
Yeah, very much so. I think that they really understood what that desire was and really took care of that. And that, again, shows the intelligence of the potters, how much they understood the circumstance and could produce something that people would really soak up as authentic. So the play of word authentic is a great play here, that whose authenticity, playing into that authenticity, and that discussion of authenticity played both ways. That
right.
Anglos were telling people what was and was not, and on the potter side, they were also creating things that may or may not fit into that.
There's a lot to be happy about in terms of how much things have changed, indigenous people having their own voice and their own media and things like that in the last 50 to 100 years. But one also, I mean, there's this thing, there's this continuity of Anglo people saying, oh, I want your religion, and I want to deepen myself through your beautiful religion, but I know how to do everything else better than you. And that was going on then, and that's going on now.
That is. I think that that's a tough question. Let me see if I can answer that. I think that people have always felt that there was a time, the dominant society, non-Indian people, have always talked about this other time when Indian cultures were here, and that they've talked about them in a historic way. And I think that what we see through Indian Market is just how dynamic these cultures are, and that the very reason that even given all the oppression and disease and warfare, taking kids away, all the horrible things that have happened, that these communities are still strong. And I think that one of the things that's happened over these 90 years through Indian Market is we've seen that strength demonstrated again and again. So just taking just from that first portrait of that first market, here are people who were told in no uncertain terms to change and that their culture had no value. Just flip then to 90 years later, to 2012, and you have artists who kids are making all sorts of choices. They're going off to law school and going to medical school. So it's a totally, it's the same world in the sense that people are still making choices, but what's happened is that Native people, through participation in the economy, have been able to be more self-directed in the choices that they're able to take, whereas probably in 1920 it was more difficult for someone to go off to become a lawyer or a doctor. Now it's a much more accepted, but still kind of sometimes very hard fought. But knowing the non-Native world through the art, teaching the non-Native world through their art, things have steadily improved, probably not to the point any of us would like yet.
We're talking to Bruce Bernstein about his book, Santa Fe Indian Market, A History of Native Arts and the Marketplace. So has Indian Market continued unbroken every year since 1922?
Well, you've read the book very carefully. I appreciate that. There's a couple years when it wasn't in existence. And what had happened, just the museum system started the Indian Fair in 1926, after the 26th Indian Fair, Indian Market. The museum decided that it would no longer be involved with it. It was taken up by an independent fair committee, and they ran it for a few years, and that's when it became associated with the Southwestern Association, which was then called the New Mexico Association for Indian Affairs. And there were a couple years, 1933, 34, 35, where it was felt to influence the potters more, they would have the fairs in the villages themselves. So on a feast day, for example, in Cochiti on July 14th, people show up and they ask the women who are busy cooking and or participating in ceremonies to bring their pots over to the church, and that they'll then be judged. And there's an illustration in the book of one woman who brought her pot that day. And then the idea was that the influence of what is good pottery and bad pottery would be much more present in the village as compared to Santa Fe.
Now, through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, I mean, the Indian, and through today, Indian Market has continued, and there were, again, I mean, it's sort of like it reminds you of the civil rights era in the American South, where you had Billie Holiday having to go in the back door of the building where she was singing. I mean, but there was a time here in Santa Fe where Indians weren't even allowed to use the bathrooms.
That's right. I do bring up some of those things, and certainly not all the stories I have, but it's quite surprising that this sort of center of economy for Santa Fe, that, and so people are sitting and they're selling their work, and what they're going to do at that time. I was just with someone the other day who was telling me the story about where they'd shop after market. This is in the 50s and so forth. But there was still a stigma that people had, and so people were not readily allowed to go and use facilities. And then at some of the stores around the plaza, there were special sales representatives that would work with non-Anglo people.
Right. Now, today, jumping forward, how is the show organized? How is it selected? What do we see in terms of the mix of traditional and, for lack of a better word, contemporary art? Mm-hmm.
Well, we like to say it's all cutting edge, and it's all contemporary because it's all being made today. But there are culture-based arts as compared to cutting-edge arts. And one of the beauties of Market is the diversity of artists, that sitting in one place will be a family that have all been self-taught in the village, you know, sort of in a cultural way. And sitting next to that person will be somebody with an MFA. And that's a great thing about Market. We spent about a year putting Market together, a full year. I'm already working on 2013 now.
You are.
I am.
And we haven't even had Indian Market
yet. We haven't
yet,
but we're just always working on that. And we raise all of our funds to put on Indian Market each year. We take over 14 square city blocks for it. About 1,000 artists participate in Market. We get about 1,800 applications for Market. And with the application, the applicants send images. We have a juring panels that come in the wintertime and go through all those images. We also take photographs of every single booth at Market, and that works if somebody has been in Market previously. So then we have about 10,000 or so photographs, images that we go through in the juring process to qualify people. It's a straight-up numerical rating system that we have to use. It's a very, very good panel. you know, of experts, jewelers, you know, artists, I should say, and experts in those fields. And it can be very, very competitive. The biggest and fastest growing section of market right now is jewelry. A 16 is a perfect score. And if you got a 13.5 or below, you did not qualify for market this year.
Oh, my goodness.
So it is getting more competitive.
It's like the Olympics.
We like to think it's the most important native art show. There is something else that I just have to say, too. There is a part of market, too, that is about community and family. So there are those people who have been in for a long time. There are people who have been in, and as a result of it being in so long, they have a what we call tenure, and they get in year after year. So we're not just cutthroat on all the juring of people in, but there's a lot to have to do with the circumstances of people and taking those into consideration as well.
And those people probably have a following.
They have a huge following. And if it's nothing, I actually talked to one of those people this morning, and so it's Raman Sita Sandoval, who's been in Indian Market since the 1930s. She and her sister, Jerry Montoya, pretty much sat in the same spot since the mid-30s. And they came with their mom, and her mom sold pottery at Market. And
amazing.
So I asked, Raman Sita's a little older these days, let's say. And I asked her, are you ready for Market? She said, well, I haven't really started yet. So she's in the market mode of last moment, perhaps. But she's not going to make very much. Honestly, at this stage in her life, she really doesn't have the stamina to make as many pieces as she once did. But what she's really going to do is sit in the same spot where she sat all these years and for everybody to come up and pay their respects to them. That is what market is about. I understand about the sales. I understand about all the things that happen at market, but what market is really about is about those relationships.
Now, there's a lot of fake Indian art going around the world, going around Santa Fe. There used to be dealers, Indian market used to have dealers, and some of them were non-Indian dealers of Indian art, but there's also this whole huge market in Indian-looking art. How do you deal with that? What is it? Where is it?
Well, let me just clarify. There's actually two different things you're asking about.
Yeah.
At one time, in Indian market, there were people who sold other people's work. And there's an illustration in the book that shows a man selling Navajo textiles and several different people's jewelry. None of the work is his. He's basically a trader or a dealer of that type. So that's one thing. And all those individuals were moved out of market through the 1970s. But what you're talking about now is a series of fakes and frauds. And these are pieces which were manufactured overseas. And they're represented very often as being native made, or they're mixed in a case with a native made piece or two.
Right.
And sales practices, anecdotally, we know the sales practices are quite questionable. And what they're banking on is people coming to Santa Fe and knowing that it's supposed to be the place for native art to buy a piece of jewelry. Unsuspecting people purchase from these types of shops. It is undercutting native people very, very much so, because the prices are very inexpensive, haven't been manufactured overseas in great quantities.
Right. Bruce Bernstein is executive director of the Southwest Association for Indian Arts, also known as SWIA. His new book is called Santa Fe Indian Market, A History of Native Arts and the Marketplace. And there is a book signing, which is on Tuesday, August 14th at 6 o'clock in the evening at Collected Works Bookstore. And then, ladies and gentlemen, Indian Market itself, August 18th and 19th. 2 days only, is that right?
2 days of sales on the plaza, but a week of film, a week of music and festival leading up to it, and the previews on Friday night at the Santa Fe Convention Center.
And for more information, swia.org. You can find out everything. Bruce, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it very much.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Linda Lopez McAllister. She is producer of the play Paloma, and Lena Armstrong, who is the lead actress in this play by Anne Garcia Romero, which is being performed at Teatro Paraguas here in Santa Fe on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
To be here.
So this is the world premiere of this play by Anne Garcia Romero, and it is about the relationship between two young people, college students, a Catholic and a Muslim, and is quite an emotional and quite an interesting play. First of all, and it just had its world premiere at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. How did you come across this play? Are you the one who found it, Linda?
I did. I have been aware of Anne Garcia Romero's work for about 5 or 6 years. And last summer, I don't know, I just went to her website to check out what she was doing and found that she had a new play called Paloma. So I got in touch with her and asked her to send me the script, and she did. And it seemed so perfect for my company, Camino Real Productions. We're a theater company in residence at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, and we're always looking for sort of small, character-driven plays that have to do with Spanish, some aspect of Spanish culture. And this one is that in spades.
Yes, indeed. It's a very interesting play. Tell us about the two characters, and particularly your character, Paloma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Paloma is, she's a New Rican born and raised in New York City. Her parents moved there from Puerto Rico, so that is her background. She's an NYU grad student who meets and falls in love with a Muslim boy as they're studying this treatise on love called Collar de la Paloma, Ring of the Dove. And so it's just really beautiful. It's a beautiful love story between this kind of feisty Puerto Rican girl who's very much in your face and very New York, not afraid to speak her mind. And Eve, the character of Eve, the Muslim boy, is just a little more, he's a little more reserved. So it's just their whole relationship and how it continues to grow.
And in a reversal of some kinds of stereotypes, she's the one who wants to sleep with him as soon as possible, and he's the one who's kind of mm-hmm. preserving his chastity for religious reasons.
Right, right. She's definitely more of the aggressor.
Mm-hmm. And he's very deeply religious and, you know, prays every day and mm-hmm. really believes that you shouldn't have sex until you're married and what have you. And yet he's madly in love with her, so conflict.
Right, mm-hmm. right, exactly. And these, in a way, it seems sort of old-fashioned that people who've gone through New York University and lived in a city and all this stuff would be confronting these things, but did you feel like your character, Paloma, mm-hmm. was totally realistic. What about Ibrahim?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's definitely very realistic, especially in New York City. I mean, there's so much. It's such a melting pot. I lived in New York City for 9 years. And so that's why, I mean, this play is just, and I actually, the play takes place just post 9/11.
3 years after.
Mm-hmm. Well, it goes back and forth in time. But I myself moved to New York City just post 9/11. I had this draw to move to New York to be there when a lot of people were fleeing New York. And getting back to your question, though, yeah, it's just a melting pot of all kinds of religions and cultures and everything. So it's definitely realistic. Absolutely.
There are a lot of themes, and you know, when we talk about theater, it's important not to give away the whole play and what happens, but basically... Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. How much of the plot do we want to say at all?
No spoilers, at any rate.
Yeah.
I think we should say that what they're studying, medieval Muslim Spain,
right.
and the book that they are constantly referring to, The Ring of the Dove, is a treatise on love from that period. And so they decide to go off to Spain
unexpected and tragic consequences.
Toledo mm-hmm. and Granada to celebrate this culture that they're so taken up with. And there are... Something happens over there that
is unexpected. But yeah. They're really there to find this kind of like this time in history where their cultures were... It was a peaceful coexistence where they could, everything could be accepted. Because they have the ability to accept each other, but it's really the outside world, mainly their families, that they feel this pressure from.
And one wonders. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about the play is it does leave you with the question, and maybe, at least for me, it was kind of an unanswered question of whether they really would have made it in the long run. Mm. You know, whether he really could have accepted her exactly the way she is and vice versa, and whether they would have mm-hmm. enjoyed each other's company, or whether mm. it was that kind of Romeo and Juliet. One wonders the same thing about, frankly, about Romeo and Juliet. Had they not died at the age of 15 and lived long and happy lives, would they have had a happy marriage or not? And yeah. one wonders that in this case.
It mm. really is an open question. And mm-hmm. the playwright, when we've talked to her about these things, says that, you know, she's not trying to give any answers, but to raise questions to get people to think about these things. What would it take in this day and age for Muslims, Christians, and Jews to move closer to peaceful coexistence? What's required? What did they have back there in the Middle Ages
right.
That we don't have now? And how do you... So we're trying to think about those things. In Albuquerque, the Albuquerque Center for Peace and Justice, Dialogue for Peace People did a dialogue inviting people who'd seen the play to come and talk about these issues, and it was really interesting.
I wonder if they, I mean, peaceful coexistence is one thing, intermarriage is another.
Yeah, right. Mm.
Yeah. Always the
Who
question.
Who knows? I mean, so many marriages nowadays, whether they're from the same culture, background, religion, I mean, it's just difficult anyway.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about the play Paloma by Ann Garcia Romero. Now, tell us more about the playwright.
She is a professor of playwriting at Notre Dame. She's got a long record of plays and also screenwriting and television writing. And I think that shows in the play. It very much has elements of film with the flashbacks and so on and so forth, you know. And her father is Spanish, from Madrid. Her mother's American, who was in Madrid getting a PhD in Spanish and met her father. And so she has spent her life back and forth between the United States and Spain. And so really is in a very good position to know about these cultures and histories and so on and so forth. And actually this summer, she's been busy going back and forth between Albuquerque and Connecticut, because she had another new play opening in the Eugene O'Neill Festival in Connecticut this summer. So she worked with us at the beginning of the rehearsal, and she was in Connecticut. We did it by Skype. Then she came out here for the last week of rehearsals before we opened, and it was wonderful to work on a new play with the playwright there. So if you had questions or issues, you could discuss them and make changes, or she could explain things, you know.
What kind of questions and issues came up that you would ask the playwright? What a privilege to be able to do that.
Oh, it's amazing to be able to do that. I mean, as an actress, to be able to have the playwright there to help break down a character and really understand where she was coming from when she wrote a scene, and to understand the background, maybe a little deeper about what the character was thinking, or even to have, you know, the playwright, just to have that dialogue with the playwright, because then the playwright goes, oh, wow, well, I didn't see it that way, because maybe the actor will be seeing something different. So there was definitely, there were definitely discussions like that. And I think just, you know, going back and forth between time period, there were questions about, okay, what exactly, how long has it been? You know, it's really great to be able to have the playwright go, okay, this is this specific day, right, rather than just a year and a month, but she was actually able to break it down to the particular day. And just, I mean, it's amazing, because rather than taking a play that's already been done, produced, published, and is pretty much set,
yeah,
this is still living, breathing, still organically being created.
Right.
So it was really like a collaborative effort. Even though it's written and that's the playwright's story, but, you know, we still got to help bring it to life.
Now, how did the playwright feel about your production? Was her vision of the play in line with what she saw you guys doing?
I think so. She seemed to be very, very happy with what we've done. One of the real challenges of doing the play, you'd think it's simple. It's got three actors, and we can do it in a little space. But there are 24 scenes, and they bounce back and forth between time, different times and different places in the United States and in Spain and so on and so forth. How do you make those scene changes?
How
quickly?
Do you? Yes.
Ah, you'll have to come and see the play and see how we do. We had a wonderful set and lighting designer by the name of Richard Hogel, who he and the director figured out a way to do it very, very simply. We only have three set pieces plus some chairs, and those things serve as tables and benches, beds, the place where the witness sits in the courtroom,
right.
The tower in the Alhambra. I mean, it just, these simple pieces become all of these different places, and it works.
And
it
so
works.
You don't need costume changes and things like that?
We do have some costume changes, but they are very, very simple. Everybody have basic costumes, and then it's like the accessories that make the change. And the other thing is that both the actors who play Paloma and Ibrahim also play, she plays Paloma's mother and he plays Ibrahim's father. So,
right.
So we've got, you know, incredible actors who can, you know, on a dime change from one character to another, and believably so.
Right. Yeah. So we're talking about the play Paloma, which is being performed this weekend and this weekend only at the Teatro Paraguas, which is on 3205 Calle Marie here in Santa Fe. Tell us more about Camino Real Productions.
Mm-hmm. I founded Camino Real Productions in 2006 because I started doing plays in Albuquerque and was invited to take them, one of them, down to San Miguel de Allende in Mexico.
Nice.
To perform it at a theater down there. And I took it down. It was a community theater production from the Adobe Theater in Albuquerque. And it was just wonderful taking the play down there, playing for the expats who live there, and there are lots of them.
It was in English.
It was in English, yeah. And then the tourists who come to San Miguel.
Right.
So I said, I want to do this again. But I couldn't do it working with community theaters. So the National Hispanic Cultural Center and Camino Real got together and worked out a deal where we co-produced, and then I would take the shows from Albuquerque down to San Miguel. And we did that for 3 years, up until last year. Then last year we didn't do it because tourism has fallen off so badly in Mexico. People
yeah.
are afraid to go there, and
right.
half of my audience wasn't there suddenly. So last year we just performed in Albuquerque. This year we're doing Paloma. It's too complex to take to San Miguel, but Camino Real Productions is sort of based on the premise that we take our shows up and down the old Camino Real. I said,
right.
well, if I can't take it to San Miguel, I can surely take it to Santa Fe. So we got in touch with Paraguas, and they were, luckily, their stage and the stage at the Wells Fargo Auditorium in Albuquerque are almost identical in size, so it's
easy transition.
I'm saying this knowing that I'm going right from here to a technical rehearsal, and we'll see how easy the transition is, but I think it is just going to be fine.
Yeah. Tell us more, Lena, about your background as an actor.
Mm. Well, I started out as a dancer here. Actually, I grew up in Albuquerque. I started out with the New Mexico Ballet Company, so I've been on stage since I was very young, 3 years old. I was Clara at the age of 11, on pointe shoes at 9. And then I just, when I was about 15, I had this drive to speak on stage as well. And so I started venturing out into that sort of territory. I went to St. Pius, so there wasn't very much drama there. But I was still definitely dancing, and then I started modeling and working in commercials locally, and actually overseas as well. My first commercial was for Levi Strauss. And then I graduated high school and took off to Los Angeles to study at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, as I really just wanted to have some solid training under me. And I just started acting there ever since. Theater, television, film. I got back into dance, did musical theater. I've traveled around the world doing various different shows. And then that took me to New York because I really wanted to have the experience of... So many plays are written about New York.
Yes. And I wanted, so you better know what it's like there.
I really wanted to. I was already doing plays that... I took place in New York, but I really didn't have that experience other than having visited. So I decided it was time to go to New York and do some theater there and really get that solid experience of what it was like to live day to day there. Met my husband, had a baby, and came back. Came back to my home state.
And did theater there in New York.
Yes, yes, I did. I did theater in New York as well. And am extremely, extremely pleased and grateful to be able to come home and do theater in my home state.
Linda Lopez McAllister, tell us a little bit about the other actors in this play.
We have Abraham Jalad, who plays Ibrahim, and he comes from El Paso. I couldn't imagine a better actor, more suited for the role that he's playing. He comes from a ethnic background. His, as he says, the role of Ibrahim really is his father's life story.
Really?
His father was from Palestine and Jordan, who came to the United States to go to college in at University of Texas, El Paso, and then stayed.
And did he marry a non-Muslim?
Yes, he married a Mexican woman.
He made a Catholic woman, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And he has stories to tell about that. His relatives came up to see the show, and his mother was just, yes, yes, especially the scene where...
Oh, yeah, don't give anything away.
All right, I won't. But he certainly understands the role and that situation. The other character in the play is Jared Rabinowitz, as a young Jewish lawyer, played by Ron Weisberg, who, when he came to the audition, said, "This is... this part is me." And it is. He's wonderful in it. And he comes from a... The character comes from a Jewish background. His grandfather is mentioned in the play, who was a rabbi in Poland who was killed in the Holocaust. And Ron has relatives who live in Israel, and he's spent much of his youth going back and forth between the United States and Israel. And so he's totally into the role and the situation.
So the play Paloma, once again, is this weekend. So Friday and Saturday, August 10th and 11th at 8 o'clock at Teatro Paraguas, and then Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. For more information, 424-1601 is the phone number in the 505 area code, 424-1601. And you can also look for their website, Teatro Paraguas, and Lena Armstrong, actress, and Linda Lopez McAllister, producer of the play Paloma by Anne Garcia Romero. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's our great pleasure.
Thank you.